Hello, podcasters, and welcome once again to this series of podcasts brought to you in association with Kilkenny Library Services and the Government's Decade of Centenaries Fund through Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts, we explore different aspects of Kilkenny's revolutionary era history. As you may or may not know, a general election was held in Ireland on Friday, the 16th of June, 1922. It was known as the Pact election, which I will explain about in a minute. It is worth remembering that the treaty signed in London in 1921 was never actually voted on by the Irish people in a referendum. So this general election was seen by many as a de facto vote on the treaty. In other words, a kind of pseudo-referendum. If the majority of the public voted for pro-treaty candidates, this would be seen as an endorsement of the treaty. As the new Free State was definitely on tenterhooks in May and June 1922, a public endorsement of the treaty would strengthen the hand of those that signed the treaty and those that were supporting its implementation. And then on the other hand, a strong showing for the anti-treaty or Republican candidates would have the opposite effect. However, the destabilising effect of a full-scale election campaign with both pro- and anti-treaty Sinn Féin candidates fighting it out on the hustings all around the country was thought by some to be just too risky. Any escalation in tension could lead to the outbreak of violence and full-scale civil war. It was with these worries in mind that the political leaders Michael Collins and Éamon de Valera, who represented the pro- and anti-treaty wings of Sinn Féin respectively, came up with the idea of a pact agreement in the month prior to the election. So this is where the name the Pact election stems from. The pact was a last-ditch attempt by both of these men to avoid the country slipping into civil war by keeping the political movement together, no matter how loosely. So what was this pact agreement about? In practical terms, it meant that there would be a form of power-sharing coalition government between the pro- and anti-treaty wings of Sinn Féin after the election. So in theory at least, there would be unity. This was to be achieved by having a panel of Sinn Féin candidates for each individual constituency, consisting of representatives of those both for and against the treaty. Each wing of Sinn Féin would nominate as many candidates as it then had TDs in the Dáil at present. In other words, with the pact deal in place, Sinn Féin candidates would not have to fight each other for seats. There would be enough seats to go around for everyone. At the time, there was just 128 seats in the Dáil, over 30 less than is the case today, and they still managed to run the country with a lot less resources. The four seats that existed at the time for Trinity College were not contested, so Sinn Féin were putting up 124 candidates with the aim of taking all 124 seats. The 124 packed panel Sinn Féin candidates would be made up of pro- and anti-treaty Sinn Féin candidates, as I said, and it wasn't split 50-50, but instead it was a proportion of those both pro- and anti-treaty. So if you think about the treaty vote in January 1922, just 6 months before all this, 63 voted for the treaty and 57 against. This would mean roughly 53% of the Sinn Féin panel candidates would be pro-treaty and 47% would have been against the treaty. In other words, the new Dáil would be a mirror representation of the previous Dáil, with the strength of the pro- and anti-treaty sides maintained. As mentioned, the overall intention was to stop a fractious election campaign which would have seen the pro- and anti-treaty sides fighting it out for seats, perhaps both literally and metaphorically. After the election then, the new government, i.e. the new cabinet, would be made up of sections of both sides of Sinn Féin, again proportionally split. However, as we all know, things are never that straightforward in politics. From a Sinn Féin perspective, the ideal scenario would have been that their panel of candidates would take all 124 Dáil seats unopposed, without any need for an election contest. Indeed, when Collins and De Valera issued a joint manifesto at the beginning of June, they said the spirit of the pact was that the hope that contested constituencies would be reduced to a minimum. In other words, there was nothing to stop non-Sinn Féin candidates running. Anyone was entitled to run. It was meant to be a democracy after all. Thus, the Labour Party, who generously did not put forward candidates in the previous two general elections, that being in 1918 and 1921, for the sake of national unity, had decided to contest this election in the majority of constituencies. In addition, the newly formed Farmers' Party, under the auspices of the Irish Farmers' Union, kind of a precursor to the IFA, also decided to put forward candidates in some areas. Now, there were those within Sinn Féin that regarded any group or individual running against their candidates as being self-serving and disloyal, as they believed having to contest seats endangered national unity. They also felt they had done most of the donkey work, we'll say, e.g. the fighting, to bring the independent Irish Parliament into existence. So, in other words, they should be given a free run at this. Some could just about tolerate the Labour Party contesting the election, as it had been historically supportive of the Republican cause, and of course was co-founded by Socialist Republican James Connolly. However, the decision of the Farmers' Party to follow suit, along with some independents in parts of the country, was believed by some to be blatantly selfish, as it prioritised the demands of farmers and other groupings above the national interest. Now, it should be noted that the British government were furious, to say the very least, with this pact. Winston Churchill, the Secretary of the Colonies, whose remit Ireland fell under, wrote to Michael Collins giving out about the turn of events. He believed the agreement was anti-democratic, which in fairness it probably was. From the British perspective, the pact was too kind to the anti-treaty side. They believed, more than likely it should be said, that the anti-treaty Sinn Féin candidates would be heavily defeated if they were up against the pro-treaty candidates. Churchill wanted a decisive victory for the pro-treaty side to show it's what the people endorsed. Churchill had been getting steadily impatient with both Collins and Griffiths since January. He had sent many letters to Collins, basically telling him to get a move on with the general election. The sooner the better from a British viewpoint. All politics is local, as we know, and on his side of the Irish Sea, Churchill was getting it in the neck from some Conservative Party MPs who were attacking him along the lines of, "This is what you get for negotiating and signing deals with murderers." Just to remember there that Churchill was in the Liberal Party at this stage and was yet to rejoin the Conservatives, and the Conservatives in general hadn't been very supportive of the treaty agreement. Collins had kept on deferring the general election, and when Sinn Féin met in March 1922 with both Collins and Dev in attendance, it was decided to put it off for another 3 months until June 22. This really infuriated Churchill, but Collins and Dev were determined to try to mould some form of unity between both sides, hence the eventual pact. They believed that keeping as many of the Sinn Féin supporters together was the best course of action instead of a quick and perhaps vicious election campaign which could divide the country even further. It should also be remembered that this was the first general election to use the PR voting system that we all still know and love to this day, although some of us may find it difficult to understand all the different machinations of it. Now, it had been used in the local elections in 1920, 2 years previously, but I suppose it was something of a subplot in this election. To see how the public would use it, would they transfer their votes at all? Would they get the mechanics of it? And if they did transfer their votes, who would they transfer them to? Now, just to give you the bare facts of the local constituency, just as it is today, it was the Carlow Kilkenny constituency. It had 4 seats as opposed to the 5 that's there today. The 4 sitting TDs were running again. 2 of these were pro-treaty Sinn Féin and 2 of these were anti-treaty Sinn Féin. The most well-known Carlow Kilkenny TD was W.T. Cosgrave. The Dublin native had ran for Sinn Féin in the 1917 Kilkenny City by-election and had continued representing the area when the constituencies were amalgamated to form Carlow Kilkenny. He had been Minister for Local Government in the previous Dáil. He would, of course, after the death of Arthur Griffith and Michael Collins, lead the Provisional and Free State Governments. The second pro-treaty candidate was Garrod O'Sullivan. The Cork man was a second cousin of Michael Collins, had been in the GPO in 1916, indeed he hoisted one of the flags on top of the GPO in Easter week, and at this time was a major general in the new Free State Army. He had an association with Carlow as he had taught in Knockbeg College there and had been part of the Carlow IRA brigade staff at the beginning of the War of Independence. The 2 anti-treaty Sinn Féin candidates were Ned Elward from Callan and James Lennon from Boris County Carlow. Elward was well known locally. He had of course fought and later led the flying column of the IRA in West Kilkenny. After the split, he was elected leader of the anti-treaty IRA brigade in the county. Lennon had been arrested prior to the 1918 general election, where he was returned unopposed. He took part in the War of Independence as a captain in the Carlow IRA brigade. But the four Sinn Féin candidates were not going to have it all their own way. They were not going to claim the four seats uncontested. There were an additional two candidates who joined the race, making a total of six going for the four Dáil seats. The two additional contenders were Patrick Gaffney, a miller from Killeshan, Carlow, who ran for the Labour Party. Actually, the trade union, which was affiliated to the Labour Party, had trebled its membership in County Kilkenny and Carlow in the 4 years after 1916. That was the ITGWU. So the Labour Party had a very strong base in the two counties, especially in the urban centres of Carlow Town and Kilkenny City. The final candidate was Dennis J. Gorey, a well-known farmer, dog breeder, GA man and councillor from Burnchurch, Kilkenny, who contested for the Farmers' Party. Gorey had the additional pressure and expectation as he was the national leader of the Farmers' Party. Initially, the local Farmers' Union had put forward Eamon O'Gorman as a candidate, but he did not want to run. The Farmers' Party had only been established in the months prior to the election and had a basis foundation of support in the Farmers' Union organisation, which, as I said, was a precursor to the IFA and had branches all across rural Ireland, so they had a base there from the start. Persons who were angry that Gorey was challenging for a seat took matters into their own hands in the build-up to the election. It is not known if these were pro or anti-Treaty Sinn Féin supporters. They could possibly have been a mix of both. They attempted to kidnap 48-year-old Dennis Gorey on the 6th of June 1922, the final day election nomination papers were due to be submitted. A group of about eight men arrived at Gorey's home, that's Burnchurch House near Coffs Grange, at 5:30 a.m. Gorey later said he had thought the odds were 2-1 that he'd receive visitors before the dawn, and he had the house well locked up and barricaded up before he went off to bed. That was because nearly all Farmers' Party candidates had had some form of intimidation or people trying to get their election nomination papers. Similarly, a number of independent candidates in Dublin were intimidated in the same way. He had also hidden three sets of nomination papers around the house so they wouldn't be found if anyone did try to raid the house. He didn't really get any sleep that night. He was listening out for anyone that would be coming into the house. From his upstairs bedroom window, Gorey asked the men what they wanted, which they replied to have a few words. Gorey declined to go downstairs though, at which point the prospective kidnappers said he would give him 2 minutes to present himself or he would have to bear the consequences. Gorey did not go downstairs but instead returned to the window with a shotgun and opened fire on the men. He placed his mattress over the upstairs window for protection. The men retreated for cover but they also returned fire back. They had also detained one of his workmen. In the meantime, Gorey's wife, Elizabeth, had run to a neighbouring farm for help. After running out of ammunition, Gorey barricaded himself in the house. By the time the neighbouring farmers arrived to help, the would-be kidnappers had left. Gorey himself was unscathed, but the windows and outside walls of his house were badly damaged. It must have been a scary time for their young children, who were also in the house at the time, the youngest Dennis being only 7 months. It should be said that all four local Sinn Féin candidates, both pro and anti-treaty, that's Elward, Cosgrave, O'Sullivan and Lennon, condemned the attack on Gorey and released a joint statement stating that it was an infringement of the Collins de Valera Pact, which accepted that non-Sinn Féin candidates could run in the election. Evidently, Gorey was not intimidated by the actions of the men, as later that day he lodged his election papers. He was nominated by the Coffs Grange parish priest, Canon James Dunphy, and the local curate, Father James Power, amongst others. Although presenting a unified face in public, on the ground, both wings of Sinn Féin in Kilkenny often canvassed separately during the campaign. Carlow Kilkenny was certainly a key battleground constituency, as can be judged by the high-profile personalities who visited in the days leading up to the election. For instance, on Tuesday, the 13th of June 1922, just 3 days before polling, Eamon de Valera and former Minister of Defence, Cathal Brua, or Cathal Brú as the family prefers, made speeches at a well-attended gathering in front of the parish church in the village of Munkine. Some great photos of that day were taken by pool photographers from Waterford. They are very poignant in one way, as unbeknownst to a smiling Cathal Brú, he had not long left to live. Just 3 weeks after the Munkine event, Cathal Brú was fatally wounded by Free State soldiers near O'Connell Street in Dublin after the outbreak of the Civil War. He was 47 years old when he died. After the Munkine meeting, de Valera travelled on then for more canvassing in and around South Tipperary. Just one day later, on Wednesday the 14th of June, and just 2 days before polling day itself, de Valera was back in Kilkenny. A large rally for the anti-treaty candidates was held in Kilkenny City, which was chaired by J.J. Dunn from Callan. The speakers were Ned Elward, the local candidate, along with Eamon de Valera, Austin Stack and Harry Boland. The latter, that's Boland, also had less than 2 months to live, as he died after being shot by Free State soldiers in a hotel bedroom at the end of July. In his speech on the parade that day, de Valera warned about the immediate need for a strong government, and in the face of foreign, that's British, threats, the nation needed unity. Harry Boland said, "If the country was to be saved, the forces that led it for the past 5 years should be returned to the Third Dáil." He was then interrupted by a member of the crowd who asked, "At what cost?" in reference to a looming civil war. Boland responded, "The people or the man who would give up liberty to purchase a little safety deserve neither." Another heckler was invited onto the stage by Boland so he could better hear the speeches, after which the interrupter said that he'd come around to their way of thinking. Austin Stack criticised the non-Sinn Féin candidates for their decision to run. Although he was complimentary to Gorey, whom he had known in GA circles, and Gaffney, whom he had met in prison, he remarked that they represented a single class of people, i.e. farmers and labourers, and not the principles of Wolfetone, which he believed included everyone of all strands in society represented. He went on to comment, "If men only represented their own interests, they would not advance the cause of Ireland one inch." In his speech, Ned Elward also echoed Stack's words, saying that the time was inopportune for the farmers and labourers to contest the election. The two pro-treaty candidates, that's Garrod O'Sullivan and W.T. Cosgrave, held a large public meeting in the same location, that is on the parade, the very next day, which was presided over by the Mayor, Peter de Lucri. The pro-treaty candidates had spent the previous days canvassing in Urlingford and Freshford. O'Sullivan, Cosgrave and Elward also appeared together on the stage in Gore's Bridge the previous Sunday. Perhaps sensing the weariness of the electorate, Cosgrave admitted to the crowd that the politicians in the Dáil on both sides had made a mess of things over the previous few months. During his speech in the parade, Garrod O'Sullivan said that the labour and farming interests had every right to put forward candidates, and the people who were going to vote for them had a perfect right to do so, which was greeted with applause from the crowd. The comments by O'Sullivan would not have pleased the anti-treaty supporters, as Sinn Féin candidates were supposed to encourage voting transfers between themselves and not to other third parties. Director of elections for the pro-treaty side locally was Mayor Peter de Lucri, and Patrick Bryan was the director of elections for the anti-treaty side. Evidently, there were some around Kilkenny who did not agree with the attempted show of harmony, as prior to election day, a number of walls around Kilkenny City were graffitied with the words, "Collins the traitor." Gaffney, the Labour Party candidate, had been campaigning for a number of weeks also, and he'd appeared on stages all over the county, from Castlecomer to Munkine to Greignamana. Unfortunately, the united front presented by both wings of Sinn Féin came to an abrupt end on the eve of polling day, however. During a speech in Cork, Michael Collins told the audience they should vote for the candidates you think best of. It wasn't too far off what his second cousin, Garrod O'Sullivan, had said on the parade in Kilkenny just the day before. Now, this was understood by some to be a repudiation of the pact, as it accepted that voters could give their preferences to non-Sinn Féin candidates. if Collins's words were a bit ambiguous, the publication of the draft Free State Constitution, which appeared in the national newspapers on the day of polling, scuppered any hopes of the pact agreement surviving after the election, as the constitution did not meet the fundamental desires of the anti-treaty side. Collins had said previously that the new Free State Constitution would basically be a Republican constitution in all but name. Indeed, the initial draft didn't have the oath of fidelity to the king in it. But when Churchill got wind of this draft, he blew a gasket, as it was seen as fundamentally different from the treaty agreed the previous December. Collins had to relent. Thus, the Free State Constitution that was published satisfied no one on the anti-treaty side. An editorial in the Kilkenny Journal newspaper, which was a pro-Labour newspaper, gave an insight into what some of the voters were feeling when it criticised the narrow focus of the election campaign by the Sinn Féin candidates, who it said were fixated solely on the treaty to the exclusion of every other matter. It was equally unimpressed with the undemocratic nature of the pact and went on to comment that, quote, "The country seems sick and tired of politicians, whether treaty or anti-treaty. The Collins-De Valera Pact has, of course, rescued many of the politicians from well-merited obscurity, but their immortality from obliteration is at best only temporary." End quote. So eventually, election day rolled around. That was Friday the 16th of June 1922. Just as an aside, the 16th of June is celebrated now as Bloomsday after Joyce's protagonist in the epic Ulysses, which was set on that date in 1904. However, the book was only published in 1922, so one could say the 16th of June 1922, Election Day, was also the first ever Bloomsday. Although it's probably fair to assume that James Joyce was the furthest thing from the mind of the Kilkenny candidates on that day. Now, there were 89 individual polling stations across County Kilkenny, the vast majority in local primary schools, and there was a lot more local primary schools back then than there is now in rural Kilkenny. One notable aspect of voting day was that most polling stations had at least one Free State military officer and one anti-treaty officer to oversee proceedings. These two sides would be firing on each other in less than 3 weeks later, but for polling day and for voting day, they worked together. Once polling closed at 10 p.m, the boxes from all over Carlow-Kilkenny were transported by armed guard to Kilkenny City Courthouse. Some, from the furthest ends of the constituency, did not arrive until nearly daylight the following morning. The boxes were kept there under armed guard over the weekend. Counting was not to begin until the Monday morning, 3 days later. The returning officer in Kilkenny was James McCreary. He was ably helped by his brother Alec and nephew Charles McCreary. They had a big responsibility, as it was the first general election using PR. Now, counting began at 8 a.m. on Monday morning, the 19th of June, and continued until the final count was announced at 3 a.m. on Tuesday morning, nearly 24 hours later. Now, the turnout on election day itself was surprisingly low for such an important election. Nationally, turnout was 62.5%. Many stations said it was one of the quietest elections they've had in years. There were certainly people who refused to take part, as they were just sick to death of all the to-ings and fro-ings about the treaty the previous 6 months. Indeed, they probably had enough of all the high politics the previous 3 years, for that matter. There are shades of Brexit agreements there, to give it a modern parallel. Now, it's also possible that the voting registers were a bit out of date too, so the Stees people, etc., may still have been on it. In addition, there had been rows in the Dáil in March, and Countess Markovicius was one of those forthright in these rows about extending the right to vote to more women for the election, i.e. women aged between 21 and 30 that couldn't vote at this time. Griffiths had pushed back strongly, saying there would be too much work involved and too little time. Most anti-treaty women felt this was a sop, a fudge, as Griffiths was afraid that younger women would vote anti-treaty. Now, it's difficult to gauge if these extra women voters would have made a material difference to the results. Yes, the anti-treaty votes would have likely increased, but so, you would think, would the pro-treaty votes. Just like the men, young women were not a homogenous group either. As the results of the election were announced, it became clear that many voters in Kilkenny and Carlow were indeed suffering from treaty fatigue, I'll call it, on a turnout of 61%. That's fractionally below the national average turnout. Gaffney of the Labour Party topped the poll with nearly double the quota, followed by Cosgrave, while Gorey of the Farmers' Party came a close third. Following transfers, the final seat went to Garrod O'Sullivan, the other pro-treaty Sinn Féin candidate. Therefore, the two sitting anti-treaty candidates, that's Elward and Lennon, lost their seats. The results gave a number of interesting perspectives on the attitudes of the Carlow-Kilkenny voters. Perhaps most surprising was the fact that the non-Sinn Féin candidates, namely Labour and the Farmers' Party, took over half the first preference votes, a whopping 54%. Consequently, Labour could easily have taken a second seat if they had run another candidate, but they weren't to know this at a time prior to, you know, polling companies like we have now. And a large majority of Gaffney's transfers went to the pro-treaty candidates, so there's a story there as well. The total Sinn Féin vote, that's the pro and anti-treaty vote added together, was 46%, which was well below the national average of 60%. Although the election was not specifically a referendum on the treaty, as we said, and both sides were at pains to point that out, in practice it became that. So it was significant that nearly 86% of the first preference votes were for pro-treaty candidates. So that's if you include the pro-treaty Sinn Féin TDs, Labour and the Farmers' Party together, which is even higher than the national average. The national average of votes for pro-treaty candidates was 78%. The results meant that all candidates elected in the Carlow-Kilkenny constituency were in theory supportive of the treaty. Elward could have taken the fourth seat if the votes of the other anti-treaty candidates, that's Lennon, had transferred better to him, as on the first count, Elward was actually fourth overall ahead of O'Sullivan. So it was a disaster all around for the anti-treaty Sinn Féin candidates in Kilkenny. On the national front, not one anti-treaty candidate topped the poll in any of the constituencies. Voters appeared to have no issue whatsoever with the practicalities of the PR voting system, as only 525 votes out of a total of 31,227 votes were non-transferable. Dennis Gorey's Farmers' Party won a very respectable 7 seats out of just 12 candidates who ran, and actually would go on to win 15 seats in the general election that followed the year after. Now, all the newly elected TDs were due to sit for the first session of the new Dáil just 2 weeks later. That was set for Saturday the 30th of June 1922. It was to be held in a different venue Michael Collins had arranged to rent, that being Leinster House and the RDS Lecture Theatre that had already existed in that building. Collins never got his chance to take his seat in Leinster House, however. The sitting of the Third Dáil never took place at the end of June, as by then Ireland was gripped by civil war. When they did eventually take their seats in September 22, 3 months later, Collins had by then gone to meet his maker. In addition, as it transpired, the new TD Patrick Gaffney of the Labour Party was not enamoured with the new Free State Constitution either. On a personal level, the oath of fidelity to the King of England was too much for him to bear, so he sat in the Dáil only for 3 months, from September to December 1922. When the time came for him to take the oath, he resigned. He subsequently ran in the following year's general election as an independent, defining himself as a Republican Labour candidate, but only garnered 2% of the first preference votes, a far cry from his 35% of the vote the year before. He later joined the Communist Party of Ireland. He passed away in 1943. Now, just to give the afterlife of some of the other Carlow-Kilkenny TDs in that election, W.T. Cosgrave is of course the most well known. He became president of the Irish Free State, a precursor to the Taoiseach role, after the death of Griffiths and Collins, and stayed in that position for 10 years until 1932. He stayed in the Carlow-Kilkenny constituency until 1927, often topping the polls. He was a founding member and leader of the new Fine Gael party, which was formed from his original party, Cumann na n-Eol, and smaller parties amalgamating together. He stayed as leader until his retirement in 1943. and he died in 1965 at the age of 85. Dennis J. Gorey led the Farmers' Party to more success in 1923 in the general election then, but when he recommended the party join up with Cumnanall, the precursor to Fine Gael, he left the party as the majority did not support him. He then ran for Cumnanall in 1927 and subsequent elections. He died in 1940 while still a Fine Gael TD at the age of 65. Garrod O'Sullivan left politics the following year to focus on his army career and his law career. He returned as senator representing Cumnanall but died in 1948 at the age of just 56. James Lennon was never elected a TD again, although he did return to politics in later life. As part of an anti-treaty IRA initiative in 1922, he took part in a bank robbery at Bagnallstown, County Carlow, for which he was later sentenced to 5 years in jail. During the 1940s, he set up the Irish Monetary Reform Association, which ran candidates in elections. It was based on Catholic social teachings and emphasised greater state control of commercial banks, often blaming Jewish people for the state of the world banking system, an attitude that was unfortunately in vogue in the late 1930s. It would be seen as a right-wing movement today. He won a seat as a councillor in Carlow under that banner, but later ran under the Republican Sinn Féin banner in the local elections of 1955, but was not elected. He died in 1958, aged 78. Now, Neda Elward we have talked about many a time before, as he was heavily involved in revolutionary era Kilkenny. He never returned to politics at this level. In fact, his name had been put forward as a TD unbeknownst to him in 1921, even when he first got into politics, when at the time he was still leading a flying column in West Kilkenny during the War of Independence. He led the anti-treaty side in Kilkenny during the Civil War, but became disillusioned with the direction of the leadership towards the end and resigned his position. He was arrested by Free State forces, but given his esteem in the IRA during the fight for independence, was released after stating he would not be involved actively on the anti-treaty side anymore. He went to America, but later was headhunted and returned home in 1935 to take up a position as manager of sales at Clover Meats factory in South Kilkenny, near Waterford City. Although those chairing the Clover Meats board could be considered to be pro-treaty in their leanings, Elward's leadership skills were obviously well known, and he was considered the best man for the job. He was the last of our 1922 election candidates to die, passing away aged 80 in 1976. And I hope you enjoyed that podcast on the packed election. And I think that's where we leave it there today. Just to thank you all once again for listening. And don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the brilliant free resources. Until next time.